WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Many Americans fear our country is starting to resemble the Tower of Babel story, where people couldn't work together because they spoke different languages and couldn't communicate. That is why some businesses are implementing English-only policies, and some counties and states have made English their official language. What does our language controversy have to say about American attitudes toward immigrants today? My guest is James Crawford, author of the new book, Hold Your Tongue, Bilingualism and the Politics of English Only. He's also the author of Bilingual Education and the editor of the anthology, Language Loyalties. He's the former editor of Education Week. America has always been a nation of immigrants. I asked Crawford why he thinks English only has become an issue today.
Up until a generation ago, 85% of the immigrants to the United States had come from Europe. Well, in the 1980s, 85% were coming from the Third World, from, in particular, Asia and Latin America. And so we're seeing a lot more cultures and a lot more languages being spoken here. And so people often draw the conclusion that, immigrants just aren't learning English the way they used to. In fact, that's really not the case, though. It's funny, around the turn of the century, we had a similar phenomenon when we had a lot of diversity at that time, coming mostly from Eastern and Southern Europe. And the same charges were made against immigrants in those days, that they were just not measuring up in terms of learning English compared to the good old immigrants who had come a couple of generations earlier.
Where are official English amendments big issues today? And which parts of the country is this being debated right now?
Well, it's being debated really all over the country, especially, of course, in areas where there are large language minority populations. That's true especially in the Sun Belt, in places like Florida, California, Arizona, Colorado, and so forth. But it's been a hot issue just about everywhere. In the 1980s, all states in the Union, except for two, considered official English measures in the state legislature or at the ballot box. And 17 of these measures passed at the state level.
Well, what do most of the official English amendments actually legislate?
They're varied. Some of them are simple one-liners saying English is the official language of this state, and it leaves the legislature and the courts leaves it up to the legislature and the courts to figure out what that means. In some cases, however, it's very explicit in terms of prohibiting the use of other languages. My feeling is there's no real reason to declare English the official language other than to restrict the use of other languages. Official English essentially is the same as English only. That's the core idea. For example, in Arizona, in 1988, the voters passed a measure which said, quote, "This state shall act in English and no other language," period. And there were very narrow exceptions to this. It applied to basically everything the state did, including the language that state employees could speak and the performance of their official duties. It was so restrictive, they thought they were going to have to close down their tourism office in Taiwan because it hardly made sense to operate that in English only. Fortunately, this English-only amendment was struck down by a federal judge as a violation of the First Amendment. However, the case is on appeal, and it could well go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
What are your problems with English-only amendments?
Well, my problems with English-only amendments is that they are very mean-spirited. That if this movement was simply about helping people learn English, there would be no controversy at all. Unfortunately, that's not what it's about. It's about punishing people who don't speak English, excluding them, canceling programs which are designed to help immigrants adjust to this country.
You know what everybody always wants to know? Why is it that the immigrants who came to this country in the earlier part of the century just went to English-only schools and they learned English and they were able to get jobs speaking English and to assimilate into America, and now that's not good enough? Now people want, you know, bilingual education. They want kind of special classes and so on. How do you answer that?
I know that that is the conventional wisdom, but in researching my book, I looked a lot at the history of this issue in the United States, and I found that that's just a myth. The fact is we've had a lot of different languages spoken here since the earliest days. You know, during the colonial period, we had a substantial German-American population. Throughout the 19th century, we had bilingual education in many states. There were a dozen states during that time that specifically authorized bilingual education in the public schools. And it went on unofficially in lots of other places, not only in German, but in Spanish, French, Norwegian, even Cherokee. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma had a system of bilingual schools where they actually achieved higher rates of literacy in English than their white neighbors in Texas and Arkansas. So the idea that earlier immigrants never had government services in their language is simply a myth. There was, however, around the turn of the century, a kind of reaction to the cultural diversity and language diversity at that time. And there was a period known as the Americanization campaign, when there was an attempt to coerce people to learn English as quickly as possible. This also coincided with the World War I period, when there was all of a sudden a lot of paranoia about German Americans, since we were at war with Germany. And there were a lot of laws passed restricting the use of the German language in most public contexts, especially in the schools. And it was during this time that bilingual education was basically wiped out in the United States.
My guest is James Crawford, author of the new book, Hold Your Tongue, Bilingualism and the Politics of English Only. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Crawford, who writes about language controversies in America. The image in America is no longer the image of the melting pot. It's the image of multiculturalism, where people come in to the country and they become Americans, but they also preserve something of their own ethnic background. Is there a justified concern that people are less interested in assimilating now and therefore less interested in learning English, and that could be very divisive for the country?
Well, there's certainly a concern, but I think it's not at all justified. Simply the fact that people would like to preserve their native language doesn't mean that they're not learning English. The fact is that immigrants today, the objective evidence shows, are learning English faster than ever before. Around the turn of the century, there was sort of a typical three-generation pattern of becoming dominant in English. The first generation would come and learn survival skills in English, but basically would stick with a native language. Their children would go to school and gradually would become bilingual. And then the third generation would grow up dominant in English. Well, today we are approaching a two-generation pattern of language shift from the native language to English. That means, for example, that among the children of Hispanic immigrants, 7 out of 10 become English speakers for all practical purposes, which means that many of them are actually losing their native language, which is unfortunate. As I mentioned, I think it's essential that we develop these skills in other languages.
Do you think at the root of a lot of the English-only movement is a frustration when you're trying to communicate to somebody in English and they don't speak English, and that frustration sometimes happens when you take a taxi and the taxi driver doesn't know English, or when you call a store and the person who's representing the store doesn't speak English, or you go into a shop and the shop owner doesn't speak English? The statement you often hear is that I felt like I was in a foreign country, but I was in my own country.
Well, exactly. I think that's more what's going on here. It's not just a frustration about an inability to communicate, but it's a feeling of sort of losing power, of losing control in one's community, and having a new group coming in, making claims, and doing things differently. And it's very much a turf issue to some extent. And the idea, I think, behind the English language amendment for some people is the idea, well, let's pass a law saying, really, who's in charge here? You know, whose language is the legitimate language and whose is not? I think that's an unfortunate reaction, however. It's an intolerant kind of reaction. And it doesn't look at the consequences that creates for people who are coming here and are trying to adjust, especially the idea of cutting off bilingual services that people need to survive in this country. I mean, there are a lot of very essential services. 911 operators, for example. In my hometown of Washington, D.C., recently, we had an incident where a Spanish-speaking woman, a Central American refugee, was being raped. She called 911 three times, and because she was unable to speak in English, the operator hung up on her. There was no bilingual operator on duty.
There was a case in 1984 where two African-American women weren't hired to clean an office building because they didn't speak Spanish. They only spoke English. And this story was used as an example of how people who are American and don't have skills with a second language can be deprived of jobs and therefore the way they see it discriminated against, you know, in their own country for speaking nothing but their own language.
Exactly. That issue was latched onto by all the English-only proponents as if it was sort of the tip of the iceberg. But in fact, it was really, I think, an isolated case. It was the only such complaint ever received by the Dade County Fair Employment and Housing Board. There is a real problem, I think, in terms of bilingual job requirements, which are legitimate in a community where you have people speaking a lot of monolingual English speakers and a lot of monolingual Spanish speakers in Miami. Bilingualism is an important job skill, even in fairly lowly types of service jobs. That was not the case with this, you know, office cleaning job, where there was absolutely no reason to require people to speak Spanish except for the convenience of the contractor. And in fact, there were a number of Cuban organizations which supported those African-American women, saying that they had been unjustly treated.
What are the hot spots now in the language controversy in the United States?
Well, bilingual education is always a hot issue. Bilingual education is the largest example of a program where we use other languages to essentially help people adjust to this society. And it's especially important for children because starting school, if they fall behind a couple of years, oftentimes kids never catch up, and their life chances really depend on school performance at an early age. So bilingual education was introduced, reintroduced, I should say, in the late 1960s after a long period of the sink or swim treatment, where children were essentially thrown into regular classrooms without any special help, and they inevitably fell behind. And a lot of them, unfortunately, were then labeled as slow learners, and they were overage in their grade, and by the time they got to junior high school, they were starting to drop out in large numbers. So bilingual education was introduced as a more efficient way to help children learn English by making it a more gradual transition, by allowing kids to continue studying in their native language and other subjects so they would not fall behind in those subjects. Another advantage to bilingual education is that developing the native language skills tends to translate into developed skills in a second language. It's easier to learn a second language if you have a firm grasp of your first language. This is especially true in the case of reading, where it's very difficult to learn to read in a language you don't really understand. So if you learn to read, you learn those decoding skills, which is a big intellectual event in the life of a child, as adults tend to forget. If you learn those skills in your native language, they're going to transfer to the second language. Once you can read, you can read. And that holds true not only for languages that are relatively similar, such as Spanish and English, but also between languages like English and Japanese or English and Korean.
James Crawford is the author of Hold Your Tongue, Bilingualism and the Politics of English Only. It's published by Addison Wesley. This is Fresh Air.